Welcome here on a Friday afternoon. I think we'll get going because I think we've got a total of 40 minutes, of which we're already 5 minutes in. And Anthony said he had a bit of material to get through. I'd like to welcome you all to today's topic about the transition to the AASB 17 accounting standards and private health insurance. How's it gone? Anthony has all the data. Anthony, as many of you may know, is an experienced actuary working with Finity. He is the expert on AASB 17 for private health insurers, working with many of the private health insurers, has been on the task force with the Institute right from the get-go. So he's the fountain of knowledge on this subject. So without further ado, I'll hand over to Anthony.
Thanks, Adam. So, AASB 17 and PHI and how it's gone. The plan is today to give a little bit of discussion on how we got here and the background, but mostly focus on implementation, where there is consistency across the market, where there has been differences in implementation approach, some of the lessons, talk about a little bit where we're at and where the next steps and lessons are. So if I move on to the introduction and background, or I would try to. Technology, it's always so much fun. So AASB 17 is now live for all insurers in Australia who are not government insurer entities. It has been in place since either the 1st of January 2023 or 1st of July 2023, depending on when your fund's year-end date is. Therefore, everyone has started to publish some information in either the annual report, which came out directly before the last one on AASB 1023, or the first one on AASB 17, and a few funds have published half-year results. And I've been through 28 of those, and also I've incorporated a reasonable amount of information from funds who gave me permission to include information in the benchmarking, which is not yet public. So I would like to thank the funds who gave me permission to do that. I will be making references to some anecdotes and tales, but I'm not going to name any auditor, consultant, management, or etc. or fund, unless it's public information. So I do refer to a couple where that's from their public annual reports. And I would point out, for anyone who finds trouble getting access to annual reports, they are all reported to ATSIC, and they can all be purchased, so they are all public. So I'm going to very quickly talk about the path taken to get here, because I'm going to assume that anyone who turned up to this session already knows a little bit about AASB 17. The main takeaway from this slide is that it has been a long process. It's been 2017 was when it was first, the draft standard was first released. We've had multiple versions of a standard update. We've had an Institute Actuaries Task Force pretty much since the go back in early 2017. And we're finally, at least for non-public insurers, at the final finishing line. Some have actually crossed it, so there were two funds who are December reporters, so they published annual report on AASB 17 for December 2023, and the rest of the funds are facing that final line in a month or two when they hit June. So what was the position on implementation? So I'm going to talk from 1st of July point of view, because most of the funds are June reporters. And a lot of work had been done. Most funds had performed some type of gap analysis, impact analysis. Many had set up their mapping exercises. Most accounting policies have been written, or statements of intent or intentions on how to implement for most funds as at first, by the time we hit 1st of July. But it would be safe to say that at that point in time, not many had actually really done a hard calculation. They'd set things up, they'd prepared, but they hadn't really done it in with a great deal of pressure at that point of time, and pretty much very few funds had set up disclosures and looked towards the final annual report. They then had their opening annual reports, which were the last ones on 10/23, which was the first time we saw some more detailed information in the public domain on what funds were adopting. Generally, though, that was very high level. Some funds had almost no information, despite the ATSIC requirements. Some funds had a reasonable amount of information. And it was interesting how similar the setup was across a lot of funds. Obviously, it's implied that a lot of them may have used the same source material to set up their disclosures at that point in time. Really, it was this September APRA submission where it really came to a crunch. That was the first time entities had to publish, even if it wasn't public, but to a third party, they had to publish AASB 17 results, and that was what galvanised most to either finish parts which hadn't been finished, or in the case of those who had pretty much done all the prep, but it was the first time they'd really done it all under pressure. But even then, it wasn't being audited, and most of them are still, a lot of the models are still being sent to auditors even now. So the current status is that I would say that AASB 17 is in place for everyone because everyone's producing results for APRA. But in many cases, I don't think it's really necessarily embedded, especially with internal reporting. Now, there's no requirement under it for your internal reporting to follow AASB 17. It's all AASB 17 is applying to the financial statements and annual report. But there probably is an expectation that over time, internal reporting will at least align so that the business is seeing information. Generally, that hasn't happened much. Some funds are now doing that as part of their budget analysis, which is generally done in this quarter. Certainly, some funds will be keeping non-AASB 17 information forever. So, for example, gross written premium is just a good statistic to know, even if it's not a concept under AASB 17. So it's never going to be fully... There's been no expectation that internal reporting will ever be fully AASB 17, but I would expect to be starting to, over time, to be starting to use AASB 17 terms such as insurance service expenses, liability for incurred claims, liability for remaining coverage, so that there's consistency in what management is seeing during the year internally with what is actually in the final financial reports. Also, at December, two funds, as I said, Bupa and AIA Health, both published annual reports because both had December report ends. So they have now, in a sense, crossed that line. Those obviously had to be fully audited. So those accounts have been done. They now have a set of results on a AASB 17 basis. So moving on to probably the areas which are it's more interesting for this talk, the areas of consistency and inconsistency in actual implementation approaches. So what did we all do the same? What did we all do differently? It'd be safe to say that there's a list of areas where there are consistency are a little bit less interesting than the areas where there is inconsistency, and it is generally because a lot of the areas of consistency were the no-brainers. So the first one, which I think it was safe to say we all knew would probably be trying to do, is the calculation method. So under AASB 17, there is a default calculation method, the general measurement model, the GMM, and that's more complicated and further away from where 10/23 was. Everyone pretty much wanted to use the simplified calculation method, which is the premium allocation approach, or PAA. And effectively, everyone has. Every single fund for all their health insurance contracts are using the PAA in Australia, according to their annual reports. That includes a number of funds who do have international student business. So both from the ones who I work with and the ones reading their annual reports, all of them must have done equivalency testing and all of them must have passed that testing that the two methods are materially equivalent. So they're all adopting the PAA, and that is important because it meant a lot of simplifications. It meant that you could instead of doing a cash flow model for the unearned coverage, you could do a simplified calculation based off your general ledger entries. It meant that you didn't have to discount for PHI because our claims tail is so short. It meant that you could expense acquisition costs. It meant the disclosures were a lot more simple. And so everyone both in PI and GI land wanted to do that, and in PHI land at least it seems everyone has achieved that. The other areas of consistency, and when I do say consistencies here, I am saying 100% consistency. Some of the other areas do still have high levels of funds going one way versus another, but in areas where everyone adopted the same approach, these would be pretty much summed up as saying these were the no-brainer areas. These were the areas where at the start, everyone was worried that we might have to do, but everyone clearly wanted to go one direction. And that would be that discounting, nobody is discounting in PHI land. That includes both with a significant financing component and also with the actual claims. On the LIC risk adjustment, everyone is adopting a confidence level approach, so probability of sufficiency to set that. As far as revenue recognition goes, everyone is now adopting still the same approach as they were previously, which for most policies is a passage of time, so one policy is 1 year or less, and longer policies was is based on an earning pattern. And everyone is using the full retrospective approach for domestic PHI policies. I do know a couple of the funds who have got international students are using a modified retrospective because they don't have the data from when some of those policies incepted. So probably the areas of more interest are the areas of inconsistency. So the first one is facts and circumstances. And this one was probably one which we could a little bit predict wouldn't be consistent, and that's because the standard doesn't actually define it. So facts and circumstance. Under the PAA, the a priori assumption is that you have no onerous contracts, so everything is no underperforming contracts, everything is achieving at least its risk margin when you sell it, every policy when you sell it. You only divert from that assumption and actually do testing for onerous contracts if you have got facts and circumstances to say that there might be onerous contracts. And as I said, that facts and circumstances is not defined in the standard. So it's not surprising, given that every single fund had to come up with its own definition, that this is an area of divergence. And it matters because how you define that effectively decides how many onerous contracts you'll have, and therefore down the line, what the size of your loss component, if any, is. Generally, most funds have fallen into two broad groups. You've got the yellow squares, which you can see is more popular, where a mechanical approach has been adopted. So these funds are usually using the forecast or projection model, which has been built for the premium round and is usually updated for the budget. They've taken that model and they're using it to have a mechanical automatic approach to calculating is there onerous contracts and therefore is there a loss component. And you can see that the most popular approach is to set that at the product level. So is a particular product onerous or not onerous and have that fully mechanical. But some funds actually went at a level below that. Next type is where you actually review the information which is being supplied to senior management, either at the senior management level or even the board level, and you review that information and on the basis of if there is information which indicates that there's onerous contracts, that indicates that there's facts and circumstances. The blue segment in the middle is where the reporting just says it's a framework of indicators, which obviously could be quite a wide definition. I suspect it leans more towards the red than the yellow group. And what I've said, and this is my general observation, is that the reason why we're seeing this split is very much based on the information which is already flowing. Where the board, especially, but senior management as well, is seeing very granular information, which they often do, especially from the FCR, if a fund doesn't have a huge number of products. So the less number of products a fund has, generally the more detail the FCR is going into and the more deep level information which is being seen by the board. Well, that's going to trigger onerous, that's going to trigger facts and circumstances anyway. And most of those funds have said, well, if we're going to have to go through a process of reviewing that and then come back and do it anyway, let's just set it at off a mechanical automatic process, which is simpler, faster, and actually provides information which is useful for pricing it. Where aren't we hitting our targets? But that does lead to, generally, all else being equal, a higher loss component, because you're reviewing you're reviewing elements at a much lower level. Where funds don't have that hot granular level of information, where it's more summarised or aggregated, and that's often because the funds have got many, many products and it would simply be unrealistic to show those at a detailed level, that is often then the board is only seeing it at that higher summarised level, and that's then often being the level which is being used to set onerous contracts. But that's not always a rule. I know one general insurer, which is one of Australia's big five, who's doing a very mechanical calculation based off the detailed model they built to do all their IFRS 17 accounting, which is a full cash flow model for every single element, even if they're overlaying that with the PAA. And that does still identify onerous contracts at a quite lower mechanical level. So it's not hard and fast that that summarised view is the reason for one approach or another. The next area of some contention was the contract boundary. AASB 17 does provide quite clear rules on how the contract boundary is defined, but unfortunately in Australian private health insurance, the structure of our products, the rules around pricing and changes means that those rules can be defined, how they apply to the PHI, quite broadly in a number of different ways. The two main camps is one where you say that it's based on when you can reprice, and that's the premium round. And the second way is that it's also when you can stop service, which is your termination period, or when you can close products, terminate products and transfer members, which is usually notice plus a little bit of operational time. So it's really a fixed date or 1st of April versus a fixed days approach. And there was a split in views on how to adopt that. Again, this matters because it impacts the contract boundary. Sorry, the contract boundary impacts how much of a period is included in... The contract boundary determines at which point an insurer's obligation to provide services to current policyholders ends, and therefore when the contract ends, and therefore the size of your obligations. And therefore, if you have, it has a number of impacts, such as on the loss component, both its size and its volatility across the year. So in the end, 65% of funds have adopted a contract boundary aligned with a premium round, so 1st of April, and 35% of ones I know the position on, so either in the report, etc., have adopted a fixed day contract boundary. Generally, I'd say this was an area where I saw a lot of variance between auditors and between funds on preferred approaches. For example, some funds said, we've always adopted 1st of April, we just want to keep it that way. Some went, no, especially ones who had posted historically an unexpired risk liability. So they'd seen it fluctuate during the year because the exposure is 12 months at March, 9 months, 6 months, 3 months, and they hated that in their internal management. So they were quite keen to avoid that. On the audit side, I had one auditor who was very clear in their view that only the 1st of April date was acceptable, and I had another auditor who said their preferred position was fixed days. We haven't had too much other alternative to look at, but in the last year or so, general insurers have started to consider this issue because of the Australian reinsurance pool for the cyclone reinsurance in Northern Australia, where they have actually encountered a similar issue, and generally the general insurers are going for a fixed day approach in on that particular one. But that's only really cropped up in the last 12 months, and so it is an area where there's still quite a bit of contention over it. And I do know that a couple of funds did actually have to switch their preferred method based on which auditor they were actually working with. So the next area where we've seen a lot of variation is the risk adjustment. So the risk adjustment is effectively something which can be set by every fund on their own terms. It's the compensation for non-financial risk. So that compensation target is a entity-specific target. There is no rules in AASB 17 saying how that is set. If an entity is targeting 2%, if it's targeting 10%, that is its own call. Obviously, it has to justify that that's a true target with the auditors, but at the end of the day, it should be reflecting what the entity is actually trying to achieve as far as return for the risk, non-financial risk it is writing. It matters because it impacts the size of the insurance liabilities, both the size of the outstanding claims, which is part of the liability for incurred claims, and it also impacts the onerous contracts test and the calculation of a loss component. I would point out here that in the past, under AASB 1023, this was an area where we did see variance. So if you simply look at previous annual reports, a number of insurers, especially some of those who are listed and the largest ones, were adopting confident outstanding claims risk margins for probability sufficiency of 9% or more. Many, many funds adopted 75%, and a number of funds also on the when doing the LAT test, either adopted 75% or lower risk margins. So there was often discrepancy is not the right word, variations across the industry, and also some variations between some funds, what they were adopting for the outstanding claims versus the LAT. So it's quite historical to have variance here. And we are still seeing it to some degree. So with the LIC risk adjustment, as I mentioned earlier, every single fund is adopting a confidence level approach. However, the level that they're setting that at, which is a probability of sufficiency, is varying. So most funds are adopting a 75% probability of sufficiency, but we do have a number of funds who are adopting a much, much higher 80%, 95%, even 98% probability of sufficiency to set that risk adjustment for the outstanding claims, which is, as I said, a component of the LIC. Historically, funds have gone with 75% simply because it's simpler and it's the APRA basis. Obviously, you couldn't quite argue that wasn't really an argument which necessarily got through every auditor. But what is true is that generally, if a fund was to take on TAL liabilities from someone else, they would require at least a margin of 75%, equivalent to a 75% probability sufficiency to take that on. If for some reason Bupa was transferring its outstanding claims to Medibank, Medibank would require at least, you would imagine, a 75% probability sufficiency margin to take on those liabilities, because that's what they're going to have to put in their APRA forms. In reality, they would quite likely have to take a higher margin, and certainly when you look at TAL transfers in the commercial market historically, the margin which has been on those transfers are usually very, very high. Not always, but often. So there was some justification, which was being used for that 75% floor and slightly higher. Sorry?
Maybe I know you've got a few more slides, so just conscious of time for questions.
Yep, sorry. Whoops. So the next part of the risk adjustment is for the LRC. So here, what we saw was significant variation in actually the basis. So everyone who adopted a confidence level interval level approach adopted a 75% probability of sufficiency, but most entities went with either the pricing philosophy or the RAS as the basis. And The reasoning here was that many entities already had a board-approved policy, which generally was a pricing philosophy, which set out a target for compensation for risk. And there was generally a view that if they weren't consistent with that existing target, then that would mean you'd have two board policies, your accounting policy and your pricing philosophy, which would be inconsistent. So there was generally a view that similar to companies in the GI space who had a return on capital or return on equity target and therefore pretty much had to align their risk adjustment with those positions, there was a view that doing anything else wouldn't be consistent and would potentially cause an issue with the auditors. That said, obviously some adopted a confidence level approach and that was perfectly acceptable. Acquisition costs, generally, this is one where if you'd asked me beforehand, I expected everyone to be in that consistent category. I expected 100% funds to take this opportunity to start expensing acquisition costs. They chose not. Most did. So under 1023, it was a requirement to be capitalise and amortise acquisition costs, but under 17, if you're using a PA and the policy is less than 1 year, you had that choice. All but two funds did take that choice where they could. With international students, you're not allowed to do that because it's a multi-year policy. Generally, that was done because it was simplified the entire accounting process and it made life just simpler for a fund. Hindsight adjustments is one where the inconsistency is maybe a little bit of the fault of consultants, auditors and actuaries. Initially, there was a view from the Actuaries Institute, so the AASB 17 Task Force. So the paper information note we released back in 2018 said that you could not use hindsight adjustments. So those are adjustments to the outstanding claims based on data after the reporting date. And that's because the task force interpretation of the standard was that it doesn't allow it. And that formed the basis of a lot of accounting policies who used that information note to set their systems rules up. However, in the last year, as more and more auditors have looked at that, they've said, no, we actually think the standard still does allow hindsight analysis. That has been escalated, and the outcome is that pretty much there is no definitive position. So either approach can be adopted. So we do still see an inconsistency there. And it'll be interesting if anyone who switched in will switch back. Other areas of difference are portfolio. Pretty much almost all funds adopted a single portfolio for all their PHI. The exception was a handful who adopted two because they have international students, and also a few who have got other types of insurance, either from international business or non-health insurance, where those are separate portfolios. On the terminology, we can't even agree here. The liability for remaining coverage and liability for incurred claims is abbreviated differently in different reports, and there's two reports where they use both different versions, which I do find quite amusing. Most funds have adopted an accounting policy, but not all. Those who haven't, and for most funds this is a new thing, those who haven't are still applying using the just the disclosures as their accounting policy, which presumably means it hasn't actually been shown to the board yet. So, lessons and next steps. In summary, there is significant variation. A lot of those are minor, and the ones which are slightly more major are predominantly impacting the liability for remaining coverage. It should be noted we've always had some variation. Hindsight analysis has always been different across the industry, both in who applies it and also how they do the calculations. The probability sufficiency for the risk margin has always varied. So we don't necessarily expect full consistency. So there is a question of, does it matter that we've got inconsistencies? Will we see it moving towards each other? I'm not really sure. It might depend on who your auditor and appointed actuaries are. If that changes, maybe it'll change your accounting policy. We're not quite sure. Short term, I think a lot of firms are still impacting their embedding their accounting policy, so maybe they'll take a look at this and maybe they'll change, or maybe they won't. This is quite a detailed slide, so I'm not going to go through it all here because of time, but as far as next step goes, apart from AIA Health and Bupa, everyone else has to actually do their final annual report in a few months' time. Obviously, a few funds, so Medibank, Australian Unity, NIB, have all done half-year reports, so they've obviously got already taken a big step. Those reports include a lot of the information. They'll just need to be expanded a little bit for the fine. But everyone else is going to have to do one. I've put there a number of observations on the level of detail from those five reports. So recognising that the three of them are half-year ones, so they don't require as much level. I would maybe the one I would pull out there to really comment on is that top one at the right, because this is probably relevant for a lot of people in the room. A lot of entities, and this is not just PHI but also GI, seem to be using the roll forward disclosure tables as the basis for to replace a lot of the existing tables. So actually, in some ways, AASB 17 might actually be simplifying the accounts in some ways. So just be aware that a lot of tables are being replaced by those two, one in the case of PHI, because you don't have reinsurance and you don't use the GMM. So, but all of these are probably quite useful if you don't want to go read through those five reports just to see what level of detail, where we're seeing some variations in what is and isn't reported. The final takeaway and lessons is earlier is better, but later does benefit from lessons. So I did see that the ones who did it earlier generally were better placed on implementation, but the ones who did it later were able to do it faster off the backs of what we'd learned from those who'd come before. So there's swings and roundabouts there. I would want to emphasise for everyone a reminder that the Institute has a lot of really useful education sessions. There's about 20 different videos all on different parts of IFRS 17 on the link that I've provided. So if you do need more information on a whole host of areas, and all the Big Four, Finity, lots of different auditors, lots of different actuaries all participated in doing those presentations, it's a fantastic resource. And whether or not final work thoughts is whether or not we'll line up over time, I don't know. So I apologise for running right through to the end, but if anyone does have any questions, please feel free to ask. I don't know if any have come up.
Yes, we have a few. First one was just in the contract boundary. You had the few that used fixed term. Was there a common fixed term that was used?
Generally, no. And the reason for that was... If we're talking fixed date...
Sorry, fixed date. Apologies.
Fixed date, absolutely. 1st of April. So everyone who was using a fixed date used the 1st of April, because that's when the new rates go through. And, of course, the government is now pushing that they don't want deferrals of the premium increase beyond that date. So everyone who adopted
it was then maybe more the fixed term. Was that the 60 days?
And on the fixed term, it varied a little bit, and the reason was everyone was taking 60 days as a basis because that's the period, the minimum disclosure period for a detrimental change, but they're adding operational time. So I had one fund who said, we monitor our prices every quarter, we can react really quickly, and they adopted a 90-day fixed term. I had another fund who said, look, by the time we realised something was onerous, changed it around, etc., how long would it take us? And they adopted 6 months. So they said, actually, our operational time is not quick enough. But they still wanted a fixed date period, so they adopted a 6 month.
The next couple of questions was on the risk margin, in particular the funds that remained high at 90%, any rationale for that? And then compared to general insurance, where I think on AASB transition, general insurers went down a risk margin where it didn't have the same effect for PHI.
Yeah, so unfortunately, the ones who did that, I don't know exact reasons for that. I think all of those are public, so they are firms we could ask. There are benefits of staying higher. That's why they've always been doing it under 1023. And as I mentioned, there is actual evidence. When you look at the margins on transfer of tail liabilities in the commercial market over the last 20 years, there is actually lots of evidence that the margin which is attached to a transfer of tail liabilities is generally very high. And that reflects the fact that you are taking on usually people are getting rid of it, so it's someone's going into liquidation or they just want to get certain elements off their book. Sometimes it's lower, especially where the entity taking it on is a specialist fund and believe that they can manage those claims significantly better than the previous insurer. But generally, there is justification for having quite a high margin, and especially a higher margin than what you put on the pricing side. Whether 98% could be, I'd be interested myself in knowing quite what the justification was for that high, because that's very high transfer. I did think the wording in Bupa's, the way they wrote it, was really, really good. They had some wording about the fact that it's a margin at which they would be completely fine with taking it on from another entity. So if you are writing it, maybe use wording like that. Yep.
And then I know we had one quite technical question from Jefferson, but I'm conscious that the next session is about to start, so maybe we'll close it there, and we'll thank Anthony very much. Yeah.